This is the Kinky Cast, an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 131 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. We welcome guests with opposing viewpoints. Today, we will be speaking with Gloria Brame, author of Different Loving, now with a new release, Different Loving 2. Here's your host, the Beast.
We'd like to welcome to the podcast today, Dr. Gloria Brame.
Well, hi there.
How is everything in your corner of the world?
It's extremely rainy and stormy, but lovely.
We had a nasty storm that passed through last night, and we sent it your way just so you have something special.
Oh, well, thank you. And it may, you know, interrupt our podcast, so we'll have to consider it a special blessing.
Well, I can tell you that after it leaves, you'll be left with plenty of heat.
Yeah.
But that's the way it is in the South, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You have a book about 6 months old on the shelves.
I do. I still consider it a new book. I wrote a follow-up to Different Loving with my husband, William, our third collaborator from the original book, passed on some years ago.
Sorry to hear about that.
Yes, John Jacobs. But Will and I finished and published a follow-up to Different Loving called Different Loving 2, T-O-O. And this one takes a look at the world of BDSM today. We went back and we interviewed 19 people who gave us interviews in the original volume, and they were pretty hard to track down. But we have a wonderful perspective and maybe the first real longitudinal study of BDSM lives. You know, where were they when we interviewed them in 1991? Where are they today? Well, we interviewed them all in 2014 and 2015. So where are they basically in 2015? And wow, such journeys, really almost unimaginable. All the twists and turns that their lives took. But these were mainly, almost all of them, were still pretty active in the BDSM world.
I find that really, really interesting when I observe our social spaces and see how transient our community is sometimes, that you still found that many of these people were still participating after 25 years.
And what's interesting is some of them were really not all that well known at the time or not known at all, like Laura Antonio was in the original volume. And at the time she hadn't even, I don't know if she had conceived of the marketplace, but she sure hadn't written it. She was a young kid at the time. And, or like Fakir Muzaffar and Cléo Dubois, they were known, but they were known mainly around San Francisco. And Fakir had just been in a book called Modern Primitives, maybe around 1991. So when we interviewed them, they were also pretty much unknown. Whereas today, wow, you know, Fakir is world famous and so is Cléo, and they have teaching academies and they go around the world to all kinds of places you wouldn't even expect, you know, branching outside of our BDSM community into all the new communities that have grown, like the body modification community, which may or may not be, you know, intersect with BDSM. So it's really been wonderful.
These are truly figures in our community. As you said, Fakir has moved on, and he is considered the father of the modern primitive movement, or one of the fathers of the modern primitive movement.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the fathers of piercing, and one of the fathers of the corseting community. You know, he said when, you know, the internet has really radicalized opportunities for dialogues and intersections between all of these formerly underground communities, which are now gigantic and pretty public, you know? So it's really fascinating to see all the evolutions and lots of other people who, you know, at the time were just players like we were. You know, some of these were people I had met myself when I'd gone to Eulenspiegel, or people that I, you know, knew, you know, friends of friends in California, that kind of thing. And today it's, you know, who would have ever guessed that our community circa 1991, which seemed to be, I don't know, a number in the thousands, maybe, really probably numbers in the millions now globally.
Easily into the millions now. And here in Middle Tennessee, I came onto the community here in 94, and you could count the number of participants in a much larger geographical area on a couple of people's hands and toes. You had a few dozen. And today, in a small geographical area such as Middle Tennessee, we count thousands of members in our community. And it's really amazing growth. And I must say, you were one of the people to bring us out of the shadows into the daylight with your original edition.
And prior to that, really, I mean, I had an amazing journey on my own, because I got into the scene around 84, 85, when I met somebody who told me about it. I didn't even know it existed. I was an academic nerd, you know, and I was really not fully aware that there was even such a thing as a leather community, nor was I aware that I was technically one of them, because I'd always done my stuff. You know, I'd always, you know, fantasized about bondage, and occasionally had found lovers who would do bondage or spanking or, you know, sort of basic stuff with me really through my 20s. And it was only after meeting this person and getting to learn more about the community that I realized, oh my God, you know, this is me, you know, this is who I am. I'm a kinky person. Wow. All the way around. It wasn't just, you know, this little thing I wanted to do in bed. It was really a whole life that I really embraced, you know. And in 1987, I started a support group on CompuServe. And I only did it because, you know, I knew like 20 or 30 people who were on CompuServe who were kinky. I thought, okay, well, you know, we'll have some place to talk to each other. And then, wow, you know, once it was on the computer, and even though this was before there even was an internet, thousands and literally tens of thousands of people joined my group. And right there, I'm like, wow, you know, I thought it was just, you know, one in, I don't know, 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 people who would even be interested in this stuff. And as it turned out, no, actually, whether or not they participated in what we would consider lifestyle, or whether or not they became part of the leather community, they too at home had many of the same fantasies. Unfortunately, in 1987, most people felt like they'd be serial killers if they acted on them, you know, and they believed all the straight propaganda, you know, and they feared being arrested or losing their jobs or losing their kids. So everybody was in the closet, but the interest was absolutely there.
You didn't pick up the phone book and page down till you found your local dungeon. That wasn't even a section in the Yellow Pages at that time. And now, what is the Yellow Pages?
Wow. Wow. Well, no, I mean, you could not even find anything. You had to read, you know, like a Screw magazine in New York and look at the back pages to see if they mentioned, you know, a place where you could find kinky stuff. And if you were not a reader of Screw, which I was not, chances were that you really weren't even aware that such communities existed. And of course, the internet is really what has changed everything. And, but it isn't, you know, as I see it, I mean, a lot of people think, you know, they're blaming the internet, like the internet did this, but it's not quite like that. What it is the internet gave kinky people a tool to communicate. That was about it. You know, it gave us an opportunity to dialogue, to create conversations that had never been held in any kind of a public forum before. And once those dialogues existed, people for whom those dialogues really resonated, people who had all those fantasies, maybe, let's say, 50% of all adults, you know, began to latch on to some aspect of it, either finding a place within the organized BDSM communities for their fantasies, or going off and starting their own communities, like furries, you know, or wrestling fetishists. I mean, in the past, every fetish was included under the terms BDSM. Today, what I find particularly interesting is the segmentation away and how those communities have exploded and how those communities thrive. And in the years since I wrote Different Loving, I went back to graduate school and I got a PhD in pretty much in BDSM, but in human sexuality. And, you know, so I have continued to study the evolution and how different it has all become and how unpredictable it was.
Of your original participants that you could go back and interview, how had the internet affected their lives, this global expansion of our community? How did that affect your original participants beyond the celebrities that became? How did it affect more common participant from the original book?
I would say that for many of the originals, I mean, these were, you know, most of these people, each of them were in their own right pioneers, you know, because with only a handful of private people. And by the way, you know, there is a bias because I was not able to find all of the private original players because they just sort of vanished back into their private lives, I assume, or they didn't pursue leadership roles or, you know. So I would say that most of the people who we interviewed back in 1993 actually have had fairly stable personal relationships. Many of them were still married to the people they were married to back in 1991. You know, I'm still married to my husband, William Brain, my co-author, you know. And I thought that, you know, originally one of the thoughts that I had was it would be a wonderful way of proving that BDSM relationships, far from the old belief that, you know, we were unstable people who couldn't form happy relationships or were self-destructive. Quite the contrary, you know, the evolution of some of these relationships has been pretty marvelous in and of itself. And how we also interviewed, by the way, everybody we interviewed in the book had at least 20 years of being in the lifestyle. And to supplement the 19, I interviewed an additional 12 people. Some of them are most famous leather people like Race Bannon and Patrick Mulcahy and now Justin Tannis, who does a lot of education, and Karen Kalinowski, the sex lady, and all of these other people who have become pretty famous in their own right. And I would say that everybody says that what the internet has done has allowed us to see, first of all, that we're, my God, definitely not alone. You know, 20 years ago, we all kind of felt very marginalized. And today, it's like, oh my God, you know, a constant influx of new people, you know, constant change. And another thing that has happened, I think, most remarkably, is that today's scene doesn't look anything like the old scene.
Not at all.
Today's etiquette is nothing like the old etiquette. You know, when we were talking about things like old guard, and it seemed very important, you know, and maintaining lifestyle protocols and, you know, training to be a submissive and all of that stuff. I think the biggest change, which a lot of people haven't yet adapted to, you know, there were like basically two points of view. One, the world has gone to shit because the scene has fallen apart and we don't, you know, and we don't even recognize it. That was sort of one meme. And the other one was, oh my God, the world is so much better. Look at all these people who are now involved in doing it their own way. and we're learning from them.
Well, that is something that's very common in all communities, though, is many of the old-timers long for the past days that they knew, and they haven't evolved in the new world.
Right, and what's really fascinating to me is you take somebody like Fakir, who was our oldest contributor to this book at age 85, right? And you can imagine the transitions and the change that he's seen in, you know, he started piercing himself and then, you know, and doing masochistic things when he was like 13. So you can imagine 72 years later, how much change has been wrought in everything, how things that he once did that were completely unacceptable are now things people beg to see him do in public spaces, you know? So, oddly enough, I feel like he was one of the people who has actually adapted the best. He is a really amazing and kind of transcendent figure along with his wife, Cleo. And both of them really accept and embrace change. And that's really the key, you know, to me.
Yes.
I've changed too. You know, we've all changed our, you know, you learn, for example, I've been in a lifestyle relationship, well, since my marriage, but, you know, we have a submissive who's lived with us for 16 years and who we consider our permanent partner, you know, our life partner. And we can see that even there, you know, I mean, she's probably evolved even more than we have in terms of self-defining what it is to be submissive. You know, when she came into the scene, she fully believed that there was a protocol and a way a submissive has to be and, you know, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And as we've grown as a triad over a couple of decades, you know, things have definitely... The roles haven't shifted, but the way we live our lifestyle has definitely evolved over time. And it's evolved according to what's practical and what's happening today and opportunities exist today. We have a lot cooler toys, for one.
We do, but there's also the point that we have more role models now than we did before. So people see more different types of relationships that they can pick and choose as the various components and aspects they want to include in their own. And as we said, just a couple of decades ago, we only had a few thousand people publicly known in the community. And so there was a whole lot less diversity to view and to draw upon.
Right. And I would say that's been a big piece of how things have evolved as well, is that, you know, there was a time when you got into the community because you needed to play. You know, you needed to have that outlet. And if you could find somebody whose kinks aligned well enough with yours that you could do a scene with them in public, that was like, you know, an awesome experience that you could treasure, you know, for weeks to come, or maybe it would draw you back to the club week after week in search of those opportunities. I think that today the expectation is not just to go and have play, but it's more to form a balanced, happy, permanent relationship that includes play. And that's a new and very healthy, in my view, now that I'm a sex therapist, but, you know, that's really a new standard in the world of BDSM.
Well, as you said before, play was just a play because we had to keep these parts of ourselves so buried and hidden away from life that many of us maintained very public personas that were traditional and fit in with the society as a whole. But over the past couple of decades, this diversity in expression has become more acceptable. And look at the number of tattoos that you see out there. Tattoos used to be a very taboo topic, and now they are a passage for every 20-something.
Right. And, you know, when you said, you know, I'm sort of like one of the original BDSM whatevers, demystifiers or mythbusters.
You are a mythbuster. You're a mythbuster. That's a good term.
You know, a mythbuster or, you know, somebody who opened it to the mainstream, which actually, you know, we got criticized for in certain segments of the community at the time. about, you know, well, now you've opened our world, you know, and what made it good was a secret world, which I don't agree with. But anyway, but I think what has actually been really interesting and fascinating for us is that there, you know, there are tons of people who are doing BDSM today who think that because they're so much younger than us, you know, they think that this was always the world, that there are certain things, like one thing I talked about in the book, which I think is funny to me anyway, is like the expression safe words are really now, like, everybody knows what that means. I see people on television shows using safe words, or, you know, you go to some, I don't know whether it's a dating site or, you know, warn your child about, you know, predator site, you know, and everybody is familiar with the concept of safe words. But most of the people who use the term safe words have no idea that it really originated with the BDSM community, because we were so safety conscious that we came up with safe words and safe signals and all of these other safe sex kinds of terms to help us separate abuse from BDSM. And now some of these words are out there and they've just infiltrated into social consciousness and nobody knows where it came from, but they accept it as a legitimate philosophy, if you will, right? You know, to be consensual in all your play and stuff like that. And it's the same with tattoos and piercing and body modification and, you know, a lot of the fetishes that are out there, you know, the woolly fetish or the furry fetish or splosh, or even, you know, people with a fetish for older people, you know, they have, you know, particularly if they're under 40 or under 30, you know, they're not thinking BDSM. They don't realize that the framework for a lot of these things actually evolved out of the BDSM world. They may never have read my book or even have heard of me.
Well, now, if we could share something else with the world in the whole, it'd be wonderful if we could share our communication skills with them. Because in the kink community, I find that our communication skills are fantastic compared right. to compared to the typical dating social interaction that most people partake in.
Right. And again, you know, everything is sort of a double-edged sword. You know, on one hand, I think that a lot of us from that generation were extremely conscious of consent and fearful of non-consent because we had been raised in the belief that what we did was inherently abnormal and inherently unsafe. And now you can compare that to a world where we've been really mainstreamed, and especially by a book like 50 Shades of Grey, right? Which really makes it seem like, you know, everybody and anybody might be doing this, including your, you know, a hot billionaire and a, and an average girl, you know, that kind of a thing. So I would say that today the good side is that people don't fear it the way they used to, or they don't believe it says something bad about them. And I cited a study that a toy maker, Lilo, had done. So it's, you know, not scientific, but it is a very interesting sort of sociological trend study. And it showed that as many as like 95% of people under, you know, between the ages of 18 and 25 have experimented with some form of kink. Whether some toy or some kinky act or some kinky fetish or something like that. And, you know, I think that's really great that people are giving themselves permission and are not demonizing it and are not haunted the way people of my generation still are, you know, with this profound anxiety that there's something really dirty and wrong about kink. You know, I see a lot of clients, you know, and if they're over the age of, let's say, 50, they're still haunted by what they were taught in their youth, you know, and, but on the other hand, that made them put a lot of brakes on what they did. So they may have been less inclined to take some of the risks that kids today are taking. You see what I mean?
This is definitely true.
Today's hookup is not happening at a BDSM club or at a group like Eulenspiegel where you sit around and have dialogue. You know, today's hookup hookup is on FaceTime or, you know, Instagram or, I don't know, you know, any one of the myriad platforms where you can just post a profile and get a hookup with somebody local.
Do you think this is an inherent human condition, though, in our generation? I'm in my 50s, that we had this desire for secrecy because it was our sexuality, and we've been taught that that was a private thing. Do you actually think that might be a human condition, that today these hookups are happening in these private spaces again because people are just still a bit protective of their sexual identity?
Actually not. I don't see that quite as much. I see a lot of young people who are infinitely more open and readily willing to discuss their interests with any friends who are willing to listen, you know, or they're not waiting for that one person they can share their secret kink with. Not when you can go on the internet and find a website and see that 10,000 or 40,000 people visit that website and nobody seems to be getting hurt. And that's the perception, you know, that this stuff is now more mainstream and more acceptable. And I don't think there's the same shame factor that older people are, many of them are still dealing with about sex in general. Not just, I mean, you know, the typical American, in my view, conservative American, you know, still walking around with anxiety. Does my penis offend? Does my pussy smell funny? You know, those kinds of, you know, they still have those kinds of attitudes. Whereas today's kids, they're shaving their genitals. They're taking photos of them. You know, every young guy is sending dick pics to girls. I mean, that just simply was not part of the consciousness before. And so I do feel that one thing the internet has done is it has forged in its own way a new consciousness about the diversity of sex and gender. I think overall that's a positive thing. I don't think hookups are necessarily that positive, but not for the reasons you might think. Not because I think that people are more at risk of BDSM accidents. I think it's just because casual sex presents risks. You don't know who you're getting involved with. You don't know what their sex history was. You don't know what disease they might be carrying. I think it's an equal stranger danger that is by no means limited to BDSM encounters.
Definitely not. We hear about people on college campuses getting in trouble with stalkers all the time because they were too casual about some part of their life.
Right. I've noticed, you know, because I read everything. So, I mean, I've noticed, like, over the last several years, there have been a number of court cases where involving BDSM relationships that went horribly wrong. You know, like, the master turned out to be a monster. You know, I mean, he wasn't a master at all. He was a violent person and he killed somebody or, you know, that kind of a thing. And I've always viewed that, you know, predators do prey on our community, you know, flying the flag of, yeah, I'm a BDSMer and I understand safe words and consent. But, you know, they don't actually. They're just psychos. And what's interesting to me is that BDSM will always play a large role in the trial, as if BDSM itself is going on trial rather than the mental health of the people involved. I think, or no doubt, more problems and crimes against people who met online and who never got involved in BDSM. And they don't demonize their sex lives the way they still will demonize, or they don't, you know, bring it into court. But sir, you know, she wanted her pussy licked and then he strangled her and maybe pussy licking is the problem. You know, the way they'll say, well, she wanted to be tied up and then he strangled her and her being tied up was the problem. See what I mean?
Definitely the shield laws are applied differently in BDSM cases, I believe, than they are applied in cases where there was no fetish or BDSM activity. I think there's definitely a difference in the way that the shield laws are applied. But it makes for such good news and such tantalizing moments that we just seem to be incapable of resisting it as a society.
Well, you know, it gives mainstream in America, first of all, it reinforces the conservative view that there's something fundamentally sleazy about this stuff, right? Which is really the old way of thinking, right? Let's call it pre-21st century way of thinking about sex, which was all based on Freud and what psychiatrists said. And they were completely wrong, actually, about sex. My new books are all about, you know, how wrong they were and what today's science shows us, which sounds infinitely more realistic because, you know, it can be proven as opposed to theoretical, like, oh, if you're gay, you're obviously perturbed and abnormal and need to be put in treatment and given shock therapy. You know, we've come a long way since then, or we like to think we do.
We like to think we have, but there's still some corners of the world that hasn't happened. Just look at just look at the number of bathroom bills examined in the various state legislators during the past year.
Right, exactly. And I think it has happened in the youth population. I think it's happened in people under 40. But it hasn't happened, let's say, in the court system where many of the laws from the 1890s are still on the books. And I also believe that one reason they always drag all the, you know, SM toys into a courtroom when the real issue is did he or didn't he kill her, and the nature of their intimacy is not why he killed her or she killed him, but rather the predator or the criminal being psychologically off or evil or, you know, the, you know, speak of the human condition, just a bad person who does bad things, you know, regardless of their sexuality, they would have done those bad things. But I think the public really does get off on peering into our worlds. And that has always been true. There's never been a time when, and I think the reason for that is because they're all secretly harboring kinky fantasies. You know, and they look to see, they're turned on by all the bondage gear and the outfits and the master-slave relationships. They're kind of turned on by it, but it also justifies why they don't get involved with it.
Well, we did a class for social workers for many years. They were social workers in training, and we had a very progressive professor that taught the sexuality portion of the class for them, and he invited us in to do a presentation every semester. Mm-hmm. And when we put the spectrum, as we called it, kink up, 90% of the class had participated in some form of kinky sex, whether it be sensory deprivation with the use of a blindfold,
right,
bondage with scarves and ties, or some spanking during sex,
right,
90% of them, and they did not even realize that was on the same spectrum.
I know, isn't that interesting? I mean, one of the interesting things when we wrote Different Loving is we went out on tour, and you know, everywhere we went, somebody would come up to us. So sometimes it was even the person who was going to be, you know, interviewing us for a radio show or at a television network. You know, somebody would come up to us privately and start telling us all about their BDSM adventure. Or they would start telling us about, you know, I dated this woman and she asked me, you know, if she could be my slave, or I dated this guy and he wanted to pee on me, or I dated a guy and he wanted to kiss my feet. And would that count? You know?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Yeah, that counts, you know, because they, you know, when they were straight people leading straight lives and they really had no connection to BDSM. And see, I think that is what's changed. It's like now people are more aware and they'll just put it out there like, this is what I want to do. And they'll put it on their little, you know, Okay Cupid profile, you know, and there you go. You know, it's a very large, you know, I feel that sexual diversity is the norm, that it always should have been the norm, that the whole concept of, you know, heteronormative sex is really a philosophy. it's not science. In other words, it's not really the only right way to have sex, which was what I was taught. I was taught there's only one real way to have sex, and that's intercourse between two straight people.
Well, Dr. Brain, we were not even taught about sex at all, in truth. It was the sex pages in our textbooks were stapled together, and if they weren't, they were just about the biological components.
Right.
And we still aren't talking about sex with our youth in the classroom for the most part. We don't dare talk about the interpersonal relationship part of the equation that makes
sense. We don't even teach about masturbation. And, you know, I believe that, you know, there are very few kids, unless they have great parents or, you know, a lot of good BDSM parenting out there, by the way, I would say, you know, but unless they have great parents who are willing to talk to them about, you know, a realistic standard, you know, that includes masturbation and that masturbation is okay, a lot of kids are still growing up with this, you know, incredible fear of masturbation, which is pretty crazy, but there it is.
Yeah, in the 21st century, but let's be real, we know much more about most of nature than we do about the human creature.
Yeah, we do. And there's still resistance. Just, you know, as I was going to say, you know, we're still operating under a lot of, you know, laws that were instituted in 1895 that made masturbation sound like a mental illness and homosexuality a mental illness. And
homosexuality was a mental illness until what year?
80s or 90s.
Yes.
Even. I can't even remember now when they finally, I'm sorry, it was masturbation. You know, even if you jerked off up until the 1960s, if your parents caught you jerking off and took you to a psychiatrist, which was what was recommended at the time, the psychiatrist would try to cure you of masturbation
through some very draconian methods that the BDSMers would quite enjoy.
Controlled masturbation, you mean?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
You know, but I mean, those kinds of attitudes are still entrenched in our culture, you know, especially when not only when you look at the older generation, but in the laws, in the court system, in the social welfare system, in the family court system, where people are still terrified that an unfavorable judge will take children away from people who are known to be kinky, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So the underlying assumptions within our culture are still really lodged in 19th century ideology, you know, and it doesn't help that religions, of course, have latched or maybe are the It's hard to know whether, you know, what came first, the religion or the legislation. But religious attitudes, particularly among, let's say, fundamentalists or orthodox factions or devout Catholics and so forth, you know, they still have all of that as their basic, you know, as their foundational understanding of sex. You know, that normal sex is still heteronormative, that there's really a gender divide, you know, that there's such a thing as a real man and such a thing as a real woman, and all of these things which in the 21st century we've come to see as purely myth.
They are purely constructs of the mind that nobody can ever obtain.
Correct.
But I will say that in most cultures, the religion came first. Almost every culture I can think of, from my studies in anthropology, their civil laws are based on older religious laws, and that applies to the United States also.
Absolutely. In fact, I believe that even the late 19th century psychiatrists who first invented the term sadomasochism and first started classifying fetishists and actually created the foundational document for the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, which is the textbooks that all psychiatrists and many psychologists use to diagnose mental illness, that really they were all based on Judeo-Christian rhetoric, you know, and the idea that, you know, God wants you to, you know, that the reason you have sex is because God wants you to reproduce. Well, how do you approach that in the 21st century, especially, you know, I'm atheistic, you know, so, and I don't see, you know, I see that most people have sex because it feels good.
We have these pleasure centers that other mammals, for the most part, don't have.
Yes.
And it seems that these are, if you believe in the theory of evolution, these must have evolved for a reason.
Well, I really believe that sexuality, more and more, and the more I've read about it, and the more science I've read on it, and the more scientific studies I've read on it, you know, like, for example, in one of my books, my Truth About Sex trilogy, I have a trilogy out there. I only have the first two books written, but I'm just starting to work on the third one right now. But in the first one, Sex and the Self, I talk at some length about my own theory, which is that, look, you look at all the medical studies. Regular orgasms, like 3 to 5 times a week, lower the risk of stroke. They lower your risk of heart attacks. They lower the risk of depression. They lower the, you know. In other words, there are, I had 18 medical reasons why masturbation is good for you, all of which had been drawn from actual medical studies, not just asking people, but actually looking at the science of these things. And it seems to me that, if anything, the orgasm is kind of like a self-cleansing body experience that improves longevity. You actually, you know, the more orgasms you have, technically, the healthier you are. The better your prostate system, you know, the better your skin quality, the better your state of mind. And so I think that sex, far from being something that was given to us uniquely to reproduce and repopulate the earth, that actually sex is wired into us so we have a constant source of self-renewal and self-refreshment within our own bodies. You know, an orgasm is better than a glass of wine for you.
Oh, certainly is, but a glass of red wine with orgasms really good.
But I mean, you know, like, we teach people, brush your teeth twice a day, take a shower every morning. You know, these are the most important things that'll keep you healthy. No, actually, if you did neither of those things but had an orgasm, you might actually, I'm not saying stop brushing your teeth, please do that too, but you know, when you look at what you actually gain from a shower, or what you actually gain from 10 minutes of fitness in the morning, or what you actually gain from brushing your teeth, and then compare it to what you actually gain from an orgasm, on a, you know, just looked at medically, orgasm is the standout winner in all categories for total body health, you know?
If we can only make this more of a national focus, I can see orgasm rooms becoming commonplace in corporate America.
You know, it would not be a bad thing.
I think you have a more productive and focused workforce.
I think you would. If people could go into, you know, a quiet little chamber where they had, you know, options, and they were, you know, encouraged to do that during times of high stress. In a former life, I worked on Wall Street. And when the going got rough, everybody peeled off to the bathroom to do coke. Well, imagine if they could have peeled off to an orgasm room. I think it would have been, in the end, a lot more productive.
I think it would have been far healthier and better financially, too, for that matter.
No kidding. You know, you have to wonder about people who come back. You know, I would see them. They'd come back, you know, like, you know, playing with their noses, and then they'd sit down and twitch their way through the rest of the afternoon. I mean, orgasm is still considered a source of great shame to people. And I don't know when or if that will change. I have a feeling that probably somewhere in our primitive brain, we do have an instinct to have sex in a more private setting. I don't think all of the shame is taught. I think some of it is probably just how we're wired, because it's too pervasive in too many cultures, even including among people who may not have had, you know, I did not have a religious upbringing by any means, but I definitely got the sense from my parents that sex was a private enterprise.
And we have a whole set of laws in this nation to ensure that that remains the case.
Right. And to some degree, you know, looking at it as a sexologist, I see value in that, because I don't think we could live like bonobos and survive. In other words, I don't think we could all have as much sex as we wanted all the time and still build a civilization.
My knee-jerk is to agree with you, but I wonder what the level would become in the end.
Right, and there's really no way of knowing that. You know, there's no way of knowing what would happen if everybody felt entitled to have all the orgasms they wanted when they wanted it. You know, would it ultimately normalize? I mean, like, I've been a very sexually free person for most all of my adulthood, really. I mean, even before I got in, you know, the reason I was able to get into BDSM so readily is that I'd already been adventuring and exploring and pretty uninhibited, you know, because I came out of sort of I was a hippie child, free love child kind of person. It's impossible to know how we would really be. You know, would we all be sex maniacs like chimps and really prioritize our sex life? Would all of our other, you know, our atavistic things, our community needs, our social needs, you know, would we be more productive? Would we be less productive? I think that's a human experiment we'll never be able to have. Just as, you know, people think, you know, they know what's natural for humans, and I would argue that we don't have a clue.
As I say, we know much more about other animals in nature than we do about our own beast.
But we don't understand sex drive. We absolutely don't. Not in nature, not among people. We may study their patterns and their habits, but unfortunately a lot of people still project human expectations even onto animal creatures. You know, that's why, for example, it's always a source of, you know, surprise and delight. Oh my God, we found, you know, homosexual penguins. What a shock. You know, to me, why wouldn't there be homosexual penguins? They're probably homosexuals, animals in every species. Why wouldn't there be?
What makes that a unique human condition?
It's not a unique human condition. Why do you even think that way? Well, that's because people once thought that you were really perverted to be gay and that, you know, and that queer was abnormal and therefore that it must have been your choice to be wicked. Right? That's why the law punishes you, and that's why psychiatrists try to cure you, because you are so demented, you're making a stubborn choice to be gay, rather than, no, actually, it's a genetic feature, no doubt, and we're very close to figuring out which, you know, exactly how, and is there a marker, but, you know, there was like a new study which didn't even make it in the book, but which basically reaffirms stuff that I said in other books, which is, you know, kill all, you know, like the Nazis tried to kill all the gay people in Germany. It's never going to work. There's no such thing. You'd have to kill every human on earth because most of us probably carry a marker for that. And whether it's recessive or dominant just depends on the Mendelian luck of the draw.
Homosexuality is not a only learned behavior. Certainly it can be a learned behavior, but it's mostly biological, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree.
The predisposition for it.
Any behavior can be learned, and any behavior can be encouraged. Otherwise, you wouldn't see so many unhappy monogamous people. You know, there are a lot of monogamous people who are really probably wired to be swingers or polyamorous or queer or bi, you know, or gay. And they were trained to lead a monogamous life. And I believe that that's probably, you know, that and fun, you know, or we're taught, well, you take a man, you take a woman, and they're like Tarzan and Jane. They're just, you know, they're the yin to each other's yang. That's not true. Some men, even, you know, some men repulse heterosexual women. Some women repulse heterosexual men. If they marry somebody and they're not compatible in bed, they may lose all desire for them. It's not like that. You know, we're not some Judeo-Christian set of widgets.
Well, the whole monogamous concept traces its way back to wealth building. It was all about protecting one's heritage.
Yes, an inheritance. That's right. You know, and a lot of people, they talk, oh, I want a Bible like a biblical Bible, you know, like a biblical marriage. I'm like, a biblical marriage? You mean you want to live to 600 years old and have, like, you know, 40 concubines and bear children with your slave? You know?
Actually, that doesn't sound so bad.
Right? It's like an S&M fantasy, but, you know, there was no marriage in the Bible, not the way we understand it.
Not in the Old Testament, anyway.
Not in the Old Testament, right. There was none of all of these concepts and stuff. You know, if you look at the Old Testament, it's really one of the kinkiest books around. Or rather, it's really one of the most sexually realistic books, because it shows you that people end up doing all kinds of things. And oh my God, they even have whole towns that, you know, with big S, you know, BDSM gay clubs.
Well, you know? Dr. Brehm, we need to bring this to a close. You have been a delight, as always.
Thank you. It's really wonderful speaking with you again.
And we will do this again, and hopefully before your next book comes out.
I hope so, but I really hope that people will run out and read Different Loving 2. It's a really, it's an amazing view of where we, not so much where we were, but how we've gotten to here and where we are right now. I include a lot of some of the new science on BDSM, which show that maybe submission is wired in, or why submission and dominance can engender stronger long-term relationships. So we have great new research and fantastic interviews that are, you know, journeys into themselves, if you will, each one. So it's a delight talking to you. And
thank you for your work.
Thank you so much.
Have
I appreciate it. It's a work of love. Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to episode 131 of the Kinky Cast. For more information about this show, go to kinkycast.com. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week, when we will be talking to Tariq on the subject of cuckolding, BBC and swinging.